Welcome to the Get Cyber Resilient Show for 2022. I'm Dan McDermott and I'll be your host today. This episode marks our 85th episode in total and the start of Season 5. So thank you to all our listeners, we couldn't have got this far without you. This year, we will continue with our weekly episode release each Tuesday, alternating between a fortnightly review of the behind the scenes of the latest cyber headlines, and every other fortnight, an in-depth interview with our community of cybersecurity professionals. So let's kick off today's Behind the News episode. I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity expert, Garrett O'Hara. Gar, while I tried to take a bit of a break from cyber over the holidays, the world of cybersecurity certainly never sleeps. Let's begin by wrapping up the big story from the end of last year, the Log4Shell vulnerability. 2021 seemed to be bookended by large supply chain attacks. We had SolarWinds at the beginning of the year and Log4Shell at the end. So where is Log4Shell at now?
Yeah, I think where it is many organizations frantically scrambling to try and, you know, understand what devices, what applications, what platforms they had in their environment, and then kind of go forth and try and protect the organizations, through updates and patching, as is the way. This was a really interesting one to me, Dan. In many ways, obviously, the technical vulnerability and just how sort of relatively straightforward it was and what that gave you in terms of kind of executable code, et cetera, was kind of a shocker. You know, it hit a score of 10, which we always kind of, you know, always raises some eyebrows when you look at a CVSS of 10. But to me, you know, we could talk about the technical side of things. I think that's been really well covered, but I think there's a big conversation that we need to have as an industry around the use of open source libraries. You know, this isn't the first time we've seen an open source library used as a way to kind of exploit a vulnerability and attack organizations. And you know, we're seeing Log4Shell being used to distribute ransomware, for example. You know, the Conti ransomware group are using it. Problem here is open source libraries are incredibly, incredibly useful. I would say they're like almost the pillar of many development functions. You know, I talked about this on a webinar last week. I came from a dev background, and people think of development as the clever people who sit down and write lines of amazing code. In reality, most of what development is searching Stack Exchange, searching Google, trying to find the person who's already done the thing you're trying to do, and then either steal their code through copy and paste, or if you're lucky, there's an open source library that you can point to and just kind of leverage that. The code you get in an open source library will be good. That's the reality. Thousands of organizations are using it. It's open source, so lots and lots of eyes are on it. The real issue is that I think what's happened is many organizations just use the libraries without putting it through the kind of ringer in terms of making sure that it's secure code. I spoke to Mark O'Hare actually on this last week. Mimecast uses a technology to actually evaluate open source libraries for security vulnerabilities, right? That's a good thing to do. Many organizations won't have the ability to do that. So the problem is you end up with these single points of failure used by thousands, sometimes millions of organizations, applications. These things are everywhere. If you look around wherever you're recording today, you know, spot a piece of hardware, you can almost be guaranteed that in there is an open source library being used somewhere. They're in cars, they're in VCRs, TVs, routers, toasters, they're everywhere. And a lot of the time, they're completely underfunded. You've got, you know, one or maybe two people doing a passion project, doing stuff that is used by defense, banking, military organizations, large enterprise, and not getting paid for it. And then when something goes wrong, everybody jumps up and down and sort of, you know, kind of freaks out because, hey, you know, we're using open source libraries. So, you know, this is a bit of a rant, but I think we've got a big, big issue here from a kind of secure development. You know, you and I talk about it all the time, security by design. A big part of that will be funding any open source libraries that are heavily used out there. And, you know, Log4J is clearly one of those. It's everywhere. And there are others. OpenSSL, people may remember back in, I'm going to get the year wrong here, 2014, maybe 2015, that was the Heartbleed vulnerability. And at the time, OpenSSL was like one person working on that. It was used by so many places, completely underfunded. That says we've got a systematic or a systemic problem here rather than anything specifically for Log4Shell. Rant over.
Yeah, which I think gets to me around, like, you know, so where does the responsibility or the accountability need to lie for security of this open source, right? Like you said, like, you know, like Mimecast is a, you know, an enterprise organization and is able to, run anything that they use through its own sort of security networks and tests and make sure, you know, and do the right things in that level. But like you say, the idea of open source as well is to allow, you know, the proliferation of that to actually be used by many people. So where should we start to look for intersecting security into that process?
I would come back to it as always the company. The buck stops with the organization developing the application or the platform. Using open source is a choice. No one puts a gun to anybody's head and says, hey, you got to use Log4j. No one does that. The reason you do it is because development timelines are driven by commercial reasons, not security requirements. So marketing teams, sales teams, you know, need new product, need new platforms. So stuff gets developed at a pace that sometimes outstrips a developer's ability to be secure. And likewise, you know, we've talked about it on the show with many guests. Brand new startup organizations, their speed of development is driven by, you know, customer acquisition, first market advantage, all of those things that have got nothing to do with security. And they probably got an exit strategy in mind. That's what they're aiming for. You know, they want to sell the thing and then, you know, go and live in the Bahamas or whatever. And then it becomes the problem of whoever acquires the organization or the platform going forward. So I think the incentives are all wrong in terms of development. But ultimately, the responsibility has to lie with the organization developing the platform, the appliance, whatever it may be. And I would call it, you're generally going to get better code by using a library than somebody sitting down. And I'll say this as somebody who was a really bad developer. It was really good at the UI side. I was, in hindsight, just not a good developer. Because my job was, here's a one-page sheet. Go make that thing. And you've got to have it done in 3 months. And then there's a lot of 12-hour days as you're frantically just trying to get a thing out the door. And it's Swiss cheese when it comes to security. So, you know, my 2 cents would be very much like security. You know, we talk about this on the show. You move to the cloud, you still own the risk. You don't get to outsource your risk and you don't get to outsource your responsibility. Same applies to code.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great way of summing it up there and, making sure we know where that responsibility does lie. And I think drawing that line and having that clear view is fundamental as everybody goes forward and looks to utilize, you know, like you say, the great things that are out there, but do it with, open eyes and open mind to that as well.
Absolutely.
Just pivoting to some of the pretty big real world events that are going on at the moment with some really major cyber implications. Let's start with the Beijing Winter Olympics, where it was fantastic to see Australia win a gold medal in the women's moguls. It's been about 12 years since the last time we won a gold, so fantastic to see that at the Winter Olympics. But similarly to the Tokyo Summer Games last year, this event comes with some pretty significant cyber risks as well.
Yeah, it definitely does, Dan. Our threat intelligence team have put together a sort of threat intel risk briefing, much the same as they did with the Summer Olympics, and calling out some stuff. Obviously, it's a bit of an interesting one this year in that, again, no kind of external spectators going. So a lot of people are kind of then funneled into a sort of digital mode to engage with the games. Look, pretty much what we see all the time, like it's that trend, COVID pushed people into digital for retail, therefore the attacks increase in digital. It's kind of a no-brainer. And then, you know, the threats that are being highlighted, there's many, but the ones I suppose focus on would be really around fake websites. You know, again, clearly with the move to digital as a delivery for, interacting with the games in whatever sort of manner. These fake websites will be sort of there. You'll see the usual stuff like typographical errors, homographs of kind of real websites. And the aim of the game here will be, as it always is, to either steal your money or steal your information. And also the potential for BEC is not to be kind of, I suppose, underestimated. And I know this is something you've written about recently, but given the supply chains that will be involved in something like the Olympics, you know, huge potential for BEC. Fake streaming sites is another one, given that's how people will interact with the games is through kind of obviously online. You're going to see potentially a lot of, you know, fake streaming sites again, you know, fake paywalls, using social media to kind of push people towards these kind of, you know, potentially, you know, free place to watch the games. And, what are you looking at then? Potentially, you know, credential harvesting, all the usual things, potentially links that are going to install malware. And then the last part is obviously then around directly around malware. And, you know, we've seen that in other games and things like ransomware attacks. Not insignificant given the huge pressure to kind of deliver on an event. And I know talking to some of the folks who were involved in the Commonwealth Games here in Australia, the massive amount of resources that goes into protecting games. I think, you know, I've seen stats where you're talking about 500 million attacks, I think it was, for the Summer Olympics, which were obviously because of security controls in place. You know, we didn't really see anything significant. So it will, I'm sure, be the same this time around.
Yeah, it's like you say, the volume is quite phenomenal, right? And because it is one of those times where the whole globe have their eyes on the same thing at the same time. So it definitely escalates in terms of that, and definitely means that, you know, that risk does increase. And during that, like you say, from Tokyo, though, we did see, you know, nothing significant really come out of that, which, you know, it's hard, right? When you, when a win doesn't make the news, it's hard to, you know, celebrate that success, right? But I mean, that is actually what it is keeping these things out of the news actually means it was successful and that security actually had a win in that time. It's when we see all of the headlines that is actually when, I guess, failures have occurred.
1,000% that. You know, it's like the Y2K bug, for those who are long enough in the tooth to remember that, that whole time. I mean, you know, the world was falling apart. A huge amount of time and effort went into fixing so many systems. And, you know, when it kind of rolled around to January the 1st, I think everyone was waiting with bated breath for airplanes to fall out of the sky and, you know, toasters to jump up and become sentient and attack us, and then nothing happened. That's because a huge amount of money was spent in making sure nothing happened. You know, I've heard somebody describe the best cybersecurity as like a train journey that you don't remember, because there was no delays, the train ran on time, and everything was fine. You know, what you want is the forgettable journey, and cyber is a little bit like that. So yeah, spot on. Like, great news that nothing happened, but it wasn't by accident.
Yeah, agree. So let's hope that in a couple of weeks' time, when we're on the next episode around Behind the News, that we're not needing to discuss anything that has gone wrong with the Winter Olympics. So that would be a terrific outcome.
Definitely. I'm always just amazed, by the way, and it kind of reminds me of the Cool Runnings movie. Every time I hear, you know, Australia in the Winter Olympics, I know we've got Kosciuszko and Metheny. It just blows my mind, given a country that is so sunburned as Australia, that, you know, we're in there winning medals. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think a stat on one of the sites said that for every gold medal we win at the Winter Olympics, we win 26 at the summer. So, so they are pretty rare as hen's teeth, and that's why it's a big deal when they do happen as well. Moving to the rather concerning global event of the tensions between Russia and the Ukraine at the moment. We know that Russia have moved troops to the Ukrainian border, but before any actual military warfare begins, we have seen an escalation on the cyber front. Gar, this reminds me about some of the great guests you had on the show last year, discussing cyber warfare, but also discussing cyber resilience at a nationalistic level. What's happening on the cyber front in the Ukraine at the moment?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I've been reading bits and bobs in kind of mainstream media and some of the kind of commentary in, you know, our industry around this whole thing. And you know, I think the reality that's accepted, certainly in the sort of mainstream media and some of the cyber, is that clearly it's going to be like, if stuff happens, it will be, as they call them in academic world, it's like kinetic, kinetic response, as in they'll be rolling tanks and planes and you know, boots on ground, which is what you're kind of seeing in the amassing of Russian forces. But it's also, we know from history, that cyber will play a part here, as it did, you know, back with NotPetya, you know, and people will remember that was, you know, the Russia-Ukraine tension there, and the targeting really of Ukraine through EmmyDocs, which was that kind of financial application. And they, you know, we just talked about supply chain. You know, you roll back to when that happened, and that's exactly what NotPetya was. You know, they compromised EmmyDocs, and then that went around the world. And I think about this stuff, that's the real worry with cyber warfare, is that it's very, very hard to contain to your intended target. And, you know, you see it all the time where the thing that was used to target a particular organization or a particular nation state ends up in the wild. And that happened with NotPetya. And we saw so many very large global organizations crippled, absolutely crippled. And, you know, footage of trucks backed up at ports because, you know, logistics companies weren't operational, and all that came from there. And yeah, you're right. I mean, Dr. Chase Cunningham was on last year and he talked about this, that, you know, when it comes to cyber warfare, it's kind of ongoing and is in play right now. And I think he said something along the lines of, if you're firing rounds, then you're already kind of, you know, behind, or you've already lost. And I think there maybe is an element of truth to that. You know, we're seeing some of that stuff happen, you know, already. There's kind of stuff that's been pointed to as potentially false flag or not, as the case may be. I think Australia is in an interesting position. We're on record. We're providing assistance to Ukraine for cyber and been training them for a year. From what I understand, Ukraine has kind of said no to boots on the ground from Australia, but they're happy to take our help with cyber, which is, I suppose, makes sense. And there's an interesting, I think, politics here because of the H-17 flight and, you know, what we know to have happened there, and that, you know, 38 Australians lost their lives in that one. So politically, I think there's a lot of political weight behind supporting any support of Ukraine, if that makes sense. Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like, you know, and it comes back to the conversation you and I have had so many times around critical national infrastructure and the value of protecting that, because, you know, this is kind of what we're talking about. It's the bit where, in addition to tanks and fighter planes and whatever people do to do the kinetic response, well, what about the critical national infrastructure in Ukraine, and how is that protected? As I would say, is the same for Australia.
Yeah, indeed. Look, it's certainly a frightening, you know, scenario, I think, that's unplaying there, and we'll continue to sort of, I guess, watch. And it's interesting. I didn't realize Australia's role in some of that and the cyber support that we are, you know, providing to the Ukraine and that, which is great to hear, you know, that, I guess, you know, our talents on a global scale and the way that we're able to, you know, support others is part of that, certainly is, you know, an interesting aspect of it. I think, you know, it is just going to be interesting to see how it plays out. And, you know, it is very frightening and, you know, very real world for the people there. And, you know, whether, you know, a cyber attack comes first and then they roll in the troops, you can't help but feel like that might be the way that things go. But we'll wait and see. And hopefully, you know, they're able to find a diplomatic, you know, response to this.
Yeah, look, you would hope so. I mean, that's always the hope is, it's solved, you know, with our voices and paper rather than, you know, aggression. But it does, I mean, it harks back to the conversation with Joe Carson many moons ago, it feels now. But, you know, his kind of conversation about Estonia and, you know, the lengths that they had to go to protect themselves from clearly the cyber attack side of things. But also that when you do kind of roll tanks through a country, the potential for damaging data. So like, you know, kind of met it quite a lot, but the, you know, data embassies where they landed DCs in other countries with a view to, if the worst did happen and there was an invasion and there was bombs blowing up DCs, that, well, the data was still protected and resilience was built in at a sort of state or nation state level. So I'm sure Ukraine is potentially looking at Estonia and maybe thinking along those lines as well.
Yeah, indeed. And which brings us, I think, you know, back to looking at things onshore here domestically and the notion of, you know, privacy and the rights of citizens is something that is really interesting of what's being played out through the Australian federal government at the moment. And they've actually taken some significant steps lately under what's known as the Surveillance Legislation Amendment Identity and Disrupt Act. So obviously a piece of legislation there, and it started to be activated. We've seen the first move being the issuing of warrants to allow federal police to take control of people's online accounts and disrupt their data. So this is designed to thwart criminal activity and combat the growing threat caused by increasing usage of anonymizing technologies. Which leads into the second move, which is that the government is pushing back strongly against some of the social media giants' desire to introduce end-to-end encryption on their platforms. So, Gar, this is a high-stakes battle in trying to strike the balance between personal data rights and the risks of anonymized communications in criminal activity.
It is a nightmare. There's no other way to describe it. Like, I'm reading through this stuff and I can only really talk at a personal level here. I'm really uncomfortable with the moves that are being made by our government, and I question the sort of efficacy in terms of outcomes. I understand what we're trying to get to, which is, you know, more secure society. The problem is the cost and the efficacy side of things, and I haven't really seen any numbers that support powers that are this far-reaching. I would say, you know, the account takeover data sort of jumping in at a sort of network data level, but then the ability to change things like posts or, you know, stuff within an online account. I personally find that really disturbing, and also the end-to-end, the potential to try and erode end-to-end encryption, I find just bizarre. The reason I say that is quite often in politics, you know, it doesn't take a genius to see that if politicians want to get something through, they basically tell you it's going to affect jobs, or if you don't support it, then you do support child pornography or, you know, child abuse. And they set up this false choice where you're either with us or you support child abuse. And it's ridiculous. There's an absolute middle ground there. And you can be absolutely, I mean, on record, weirdly against child abuse. I mean, what a crazy thing to have to say aloud. I'm also really against interfering with end-to-end encryption, because what the cost to society is, to me, far outweighs the, you know, the helpfulness of that as a tool for law enforcement. And what I would say is, what you really want to get is onto the endpoint. If you're on the endpoint, you know, whatever, that's fine. Get in there, install something, whatever. That's up for law enforcement to do. What I've got a real problem with is breaking end-to-end encryption for everybody, so that you potentially can go after, you know, a very, very small fraction of the communications that happens over those channels. The other one, which I think is pointing at the bleeding obvious, if you're serious as a criminal organization, you've got your own thing going on. It's a very trivial thing to set up end-to-end encryption that has got nothing to do with WhatsApp or Instagram or any of those platforms. So if you're actually serious about drugs or weapons or child abuse or any of those things, it's trivial, absolutely trivial to set up end-to-end encryption. So, and you saw that Operation Ironside, you know, there's a reason that was successful, which was the criminals were looking for encryption outside of kind of, you know, the standard channels. Now, it just happened in that case that they bought that from law enforcement. So still can't wait for that movie to come out. That's going to be an amazing movie when they make it. But I guess the point here is I'm absolutely not convinced that this helps us as a society. And I question the intent here. And I certainly think that it feels like overreach, and it's been rushed in much the same way as the Patriot Act was in the US. And we saw how that went. And it took Edward Snowden to, you know, put his whole life where it is right now for that to come out. We know how this ends. I just don't get why we would want to do it. And I saw one quote, which is the need for regulatory frameworks that prioritize child and community safety over business. And I'm going to say it's amazing how that's important when it comes to this, but maybe was in some states less important when COVID was happening for political reasons. So, if that is really important, can we apply that everywhere rather than just, you know, something that gives what I think is intrusive rights to our government?
Oh, God, this is a tough one. Playing devil's advocate for a moment, just around some of the, I guess, the way that I think the Australian government does think about things and the governance that's in place, say, versus the Patriots Act, which was listen to everything, hope to find the needle in the haystack and go from there. I think that this is more designed around when you know there's people that you want to know what they're communicating about, you need to be able to actually, first of all, apply to and get a warrant as part of the process. So there is judicial process, I guess, before anything takes place, rather than, I think, a broad-based approach that we may have seen elsewhere.
Yeah, the funny thing is, though, the approval process doesn't, as I understand it, doesn't go through that sort of what we would consider proper judicial process. It actually goes through a different body versus, you know, a sort of well-versed judge. I stand to be corrected on that, but I'm fairly sure that that was one of the things the Greens pushed back on, was how that...
Not rubber stamping, how you're saying there.
I don't know. And I would say when I saw the definition of the, they changed the definition of where this warrant would apply to, you know, air quotes, make it more stringent. And when I saw the more stringent version, I'm sort of thinking, well, it's all very loose language rather than, you know, it's something like justifiable suspicion or, you know, some legalese or... Mm. A little bit like serious harm, actually, when you think about the OAIC, you know, the notifiable data breach, how much hassle that caused. What does serious harm mean? And that's what it feels like a little bit here, is that the process for approval for those warrants doesn't get overseen in the way that it should. And to use your words, it, you know, potentially rubber stamped. And then the definition for where they can be applied to is so loose that it's up to interpretation. And then you do say that overreach. We've seen this already, you know, was it last year? I can't even remember what it was now, but maybe about 18 months ago when they went back over the data for the warrants that were related to, I'm going to have to go back on that. There was massive overreach. There was a huge amount of times where the legislation like this was used for places where it wasn't actually designed to be used. That just happens all the time. And that's the thing. We shouldn't be surprised when we see the data on this and it turns out actually it's been used all the time, or often, not all the time, but often, for things that it was never designed for.
And in terms of the end-to-end encryption of the social media platforms and that, is obviously the argument is around trying to reduce proliferation of you know, criminal activity. So, like, you know, maybe it's not the highly organized criminal gangs, right? That might be that they're targeting there. It is that, how is this seeping, you know, more broadly throughout society? Do you think that there's a role there, or is it, you know, in terms of that, or is it sort of still, you know, the risks are, you know, of actual intrusion and, you know, data privacy and personal privacy being overreached, you know, outweighs any potential benefit that there might be of stopping the potential proliferation of those activities?
The second one. So it feels to me like it's just not worth it. And there's other ways to tackle this problem. That's the thing. I'd go back to where data is stored and, you know, the potential for being able to identify images, for example, that are illegal in nature. And that's the thing. For not one second am I saying that we don't need to fix these problems and fight as hard as we possibly can against them. I'm not convinced that breaking end-to-end encryption or the government stepping in the way of that is the way that we're going to fix those problems, or if it truly returns results. And that's the thing. If somebody could show me data that says, here's the amazing results we've gotten in the past from these kind of approaches, okay. And then going back, once the approval process isn't rubber stamping, but actually is done correctly and has proper oversight, okay, maybe there's a question. Conversation to be had. Right now, we have a government that, in my opinion, has a track record of really, oh God, this sounds absolutely tinfoil hatty, but we are slowly marching to, tell me how it's not a dystopian surveillance state. You know, we've got AI, facial recognition. If we're going to break encryption, at what point is it where privacy truly exists? You can't pay cash anymore because of COVID. So there's, you know, we're not a million miles from Gattaca right now, and this just brings us closer.
Yeah, look, I think as we steamroll towards a federal election, it's going to be interesting to see if this gets further coverage and what sort of positioning, you know, I mean, the government's clear in their positioning, but I do think it's going to, like you say, because of the, you know, the headline ramifications, it's very hard to fight against as well. So it'd be interesting to see what approach the opposition are able to take, and whether we do get a balanced view, as you say, in terms of this conversation, or whether it will continue to sort of, you know, steamroll along in terms of what the government is trying to get through.
The killer, to your point, Dan, is this is complex, like so many things that politicians rely on. They'll go for the populist, you know, highly emotive, you know, support us or you support child porn, you know, and it's that ridiculous stuff we've been through in Australia many times before. You know, the data retention laws, I remember, it was one of the many reasons I left Facebook was just having these conversations where people who clearly didn't understand privacy saying just really dumb things like, you know, if you've got nothing to hide, you should have no problem. It's like, okay, well, tell me your email password, you know, leave your front door open. It's just ridiculous. But what you will see in the run-up to the election is highly emotive, highly emotional statements that really set up a fake dichotomy between, you know, supporting this sort of legislation or supporting child porn or job loss or, you know, what politicians normally do.
Yeah, definitely a big one that will continue to be a story, I think, as we go through the next several months. We'll wrap up this week's episode with a review of some of the latest breaches to make the headlines. Let's start with the International Committee of the Red Cross, who have seen 500,000 records of people globally accessed by hackers.
Yeah, this one, this is just, it's sad. I don't know what it is particularly about hospitals, not-for-profits, any, you know, organizations in the world trying to do good things and then seeing any kind of breach. And even if nothing bad comes from this, which, you know, I think it's at the moment, we don't know if the data has been exfiltrated. And I think there was a statement saying that it hadn't been altered. But fundamentally, what it's taken is resources away from people doing their core jobs. So obviously all the analysis that goes into understanding what exactly has happened. And I know from reading around on this that the local Australian Red Cross have had to stop some of the functions that they would do because they can't access things like case notes and case information. It just blows my mind that people who are already so incredibly vulnerable, so people you know, in immigration camps or in places where they might have lost contact with their family. And by the way, that is the data that's being compromised here, is the data they use to try and link up missing people with their families. I mean, to get away, I don't know, I mean, I'm kind of lost for words. Getting in the way, that just seems like just an incredibly, incredibly awful thing to do. And, you know, is it somebody who didn't realize where they were? I mean, who knows? But yeah, just heartbreaking to see.
Yes, indeed. Like you say, like, I mean, the people affected here is like the most vulnerable in that. Yep. And so definitely, you know, very sad story. It's not, you know, this isn't the blood donor part that we've seen before and that sort of thing. This is, you know, people, you know, missing people and stuff around the world. I guess the only thing is whether is somebody, you know, searching themselves and trying to do it for good and looking for information. It's the only, you know, maybe silver lining, but you just can't see that being the case, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't know that it is. The other thing, it does point back to what we spoke about a little bit earlier in this episode around, you know, the risk and supply chain of all types, but the data was attacked. It was an external company in Switzerland where the data was stored. They were contracted by the ICRC. So, you know, it again points back to that whole thing that you can't outsource the risk. You know, ultimately the impact is on the organization that's built the, you know, the strategy and the infrastructure ecosystem within that particular organization.
Indeed. Well, we certainly can't go an episode these days without a ransomware attack being in the headlines. The most recent one reported is a British food producer, KP Snacks, who have been impacted. What happened here?
Literally exactly what you've just said. It's a ransomware attack, as we see pretty much every day, multiple times a day, this time on KP Snacks. And I have to say, huge fan of their dry roasted peanuts. So, you know, I don't know if we're at a point where we have big enough reach that that's meaningful to KP Snacks, but happy to take a box of their dry roasted peanuts. They're amazing. Anyway.
You're now an influencer for snacks as well.
So oh, I know. I'm all over that. If only. So, it was the Conti ransomware group that pops them. And it's been reported by one of the sort of, I suppose, retail media outlets or whatever, that the company has already told sellers in that quote here that no orders will be being placed or delivered for a couple of weeks at least, and service could be affected until the end of March at the earliest. And, you know, the reason I'm reading that out verbatim from the site that I got this from, that points to the impact of ransomware. Like, that is not a small amount of time. We're, you know, fairly close to the start of February. So you're talking about potentially a 2-month supply impact for, you know, a very well-known brand. One of those things, ransomware, this is why we talk about it all the time, because, and I know you've actually just written about BEC and the, you know, how much money gets lost to BEC, 64 times more according to the FBI versus ransomware. I've been talking about this in terms of getting in a car versus getting on a plane. You know, the plane feels risky because when you read about the plane going down, it's very emotional and evocative, and it's a, God, it's horrible to say, but it's, if you're in a plane crash, chances are you're sort of done for this world. Whereas a car crash, we get in them all the time. It's far, 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 far more risky. But we rationalize that somehow because, you know, chances are, hopefully there's a good chance you could walk away, or it's injury versus the really bad things. But yeah, this is, that's it. Ransomware is just, it's everywhere. Conti, by the way, is the one that brought in the HSC, the health service executive in Ireland. They're it seems like they're everywhere at the moment. They've hit a bunch of universities, healthcare organizations in the US. And actually, I think I mentioned this earlier. In some cases, the Conti ransomware crew are using Log4Shell as a way to get the ransomware in. So you're seeing a little bit of crossover there.
Yeah, definitely. And like you say, it's the impact of ransomware as to why it, you know, continues to make the headlines for all the wrong reasons. The final story that we'll review for today is one that did capture my attention over the break, and I sent you a text on it. It was regarding a Sydney family who nearly lost their life savings and their home in an email-based conveyancing scam. Pretty sophisticated one, this one, and one that luckily they didn't fall victim to.
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. It reminds me of, we had Laura Jeffrey on. I kind of remember the episode number, but if you scroll back, if you're listening to this, brilliant insight into the personal side of, you know, how it feels, the emotions of trying to navigate this stuff as the victim of this kind of fraud, almost exactly the same, slightly different, but, you know, kind of the same deal. I was thinking about this, as we were discussing this, and obviously, you know, you as you said, you didn't take a full break because in the middle of our Christmas time off, you definitely sent that story across. You know, I'm thinking more and more, this is a case where a process could be the thing that saves us. And, you know, I look at how this played out, and I think that if the lawyer, the solicitor firm at the start had provided a printed pack when you meet face to face, on there is the bank account details. And the instructions are at no point ever pay into a different account. And secondly, if you get an email from us saying to any kind of payment and there's bank account details, check them against these. This is your gold. Put this in a secure drawer. Don't let that go anywhere. And if it's ever changed, then, you know, you kind of know there's something going wrong there. The reason I think that would work is because it's not technical. It's really well and, you know, very easily understood by hopefully, you know, anybody who would be going through a house purchase or sale, that you just go to the folder, that's the bank account details you choose. If we're ever going to send you a different bank account, come in and see us and we'll do it that way. Just give them the amount of money, 1.1 million in this case, which, you know, luckily I think was frozen. Huge amounts of money. The way this played out and what I read, and here's where complexity arrives. Who's responsible? Is it the bank? Is it the solicitor? Is it the person who's being hacked and doesn't realize it? Is it the person who pays the hacked account and didn't do the check to make sure that it's the right bank account details? There are so many parties. And, you know, we know from Laura Jeffrey's episode, this stuff gets very complex very quickly. And you get into jurisdictions, even within Australia, where multiple states can be involved. And the handover between one police force to another becomes a nightmare. And you're almost starting from scratch again. Yeah, absolute nightmare. This is really close to me, by the way, Dan. I don't know if you realize that. Like the Northern, Beacon Hill, our friends live there. We, you know, we're there all the time. It's literally 5 minutes in the car from us. So kind of really, apart from the amount of time we spend talking about this, the physical proximity of this was like, oof, it can happen to anybody. Weird. Huh?
Yeah, you look out the window and it could be right there, right?
Yeah, so, that's it.
Yeah, it is definitely the old man in the middle sort of attack though, right? Like, you know, they have got in between, you know, what would be a trusted relationship between the solicitor and the consumer in making that house purchase, have impersonated them and, you know, we know, you know, buying a house and looking to move, it's very emotional, you know, stress, this, you know, time commitments, all of these sort of things that are all bring to bear the notion of why at that time it can be something that you can fall for as well. Like you say, I like your printed gold pack. I think that that's a nice, you know, neat solution that anybody could, you know, take advantage of as well.
Yeah, that's it. And I think it's, you know, we talk about this a lot, the low-tech, simple solutions. They don't always have to be an expensive technology platform. And actually, as I say, expensive technology platform, when I think about solicitors, they tend to be relatively small. You know, you could consider them SMBs. They're one or two people organizations. And here you go. Will they know what DMARC is? Probably not. But, you know, if this was a scammer who used a solicitor's exact domain, something like DMARC is that's exactly what that's for. But you know, if I would put good money that if I went to your average solicitor and said, hey, do you guys do use DMARC? You know, they might think I'm talking about an 80s band or something like that, but they wouldn't be thinking technology. So this is important, SMB protection to protect us all. You know, there's a bigger conversation here.
Yeah, indeed. Well, that brings this week's episode to a close. Gar, thank you again for all your fantastic insights and deep dive behind the scenes of what's been happening in the news. Continue to stay up to date with getcyberresilient.com. You'll see a number of articles being back up and running for this year, including the one, as Gar referenced, produced by myself regarding BEC and the cost of that versus ransomware. Next week, we will have an in-depth interview with a cybersecurity expert, and Gar, really looking forward to the guests you'll bring to the show throughout the year as well. Until then, and as always, stay safe.